Countless books have been written about the civil rights movement, but far less attention has been paid to what happened after the dramatic passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965 and the turbulent forces that it unleashed. The nation's political correspondent Ari Berman's new book, Give Us the Ballot, charts both the transformation of American democracy under the Voting Rights Act and the counter-revolution that has sought to limit voting rights from 1965 to the present day. Again, the name of the book is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. And it's a great pleasure to welcome Ari Berman back to the roundtable. Thank you very much for being with us.
Hey, Joe. Thanks for having me back.
Very nice to have you back on the show. When you look at this book and the story that it told regarding what happened after the passage of the Voting Rights Act, I think what's so interesting about this continues to change. And I'm just interested, we'll talk about the actual meat of the book in a moment, but just over the past year of what you've been witnessing and looking as a result of putting the book out.
Yeah, so the book came out last year in August of 2015 on the 50th anniversary of the Voting Rights Act. And so I really wanted it to be about people recognizing both what the Voting Rights Act did and how important it was, but also the fact that there was a 50-year backlash to the Voting Rights Act. And that really culminated in the 2013 decision, Shelby County versus Holder, where the Supreme Court gutted a key part of the Voting Rights Act and said that those states with the longest histories of discrimination no longer had to approve their voting changes with the federal government. Now we're seeing all of this put into practice because the 2016 election is the first presidential election in 50 years without the full protections of the Voting Rights Act. When I wrote my book in August, people hadn't started voting yet. Now they are voting, so we're able to see the impact of that. We're able to see that there were problems, for example, as a result of the gutting of the Voting Rights Act in states like North Carolina and Arizona and even in New York during the 2016 primaries. And so this is an issue that is part history, which I wrote, but also something that's very relevant to what's happening today and directly relevant to the 2016 election.
There are many states that are dealing with this and looking at, there was an article in the New York Times this week regarding Georgia and what is happening there. Is this replicated really throughout the country?
Yeah, so what we saw is that 17 states have new voting restrictions in effect for the first time in 2016, and that's changing a little bit because of court decisions, but basically that number is holding, which is both states in the South with a long history of discrimination, places like Georgia and Alabama and Mississippi and Texas, but it's also occurring in states in the North that don't have the same history of discrimination, whether it's fights over voting rights in places like Ohio or Wisconsin. So this is a problem that's a national problem. We saw problems all across the country during the primaries when it came to voting, whether it was in somewhere in the West like Arizona, somewhere in the East like New York, or somewhere in the South like North Carolina. So this is something that's not just a Southern issue anymore. It's happening all across the country.
So as I mentioned, we'll talk about the meat of the book. What is it about this, about the Voting Rights Act that you wanted to look at as you say in the subtitle, the modern struggle for voting rights in America? So the Voting Rights Act passes, and then when do we start to see the implementation, troubles with the implementation?
Well, the reason why I wanted to write the book was because there had been so much written about the events that led to the passage of the Voting Rights Act, whether it was marches in Selma, Alabama, or Mississippi Freedom Summer in 1964, or all the different work of the civil rights movement. But there had been so much less written about what happened after 1965. And I wanted to tell the story of all of the good things that the Voting Rights Act did, how it really did democratize and integrate this country for the first time politically. But I also wanted to talk about the backlash to that law. And how that has resulted in new voting restrictions being passed today and new efforts to gut the Voting Rights Act. And really, the effort to try to roll the law back began immediately. You had people like Governor George Wallace in Alabama, Southern segregationists, who tried to challenge the constitutionality of the Voting Rights Act. That was unsuccessful, and that gave way to more sophisticated efforts to challenge the law, both challenge the constitutionality of the law in court, as was done in 2013, but also to try to come up with more sophisticated ways to restrict the right to vote to try to subvert both the power and the intent of the Voting Rights Act.
What do you see, even in those early attempts that have been replicated since then, when it comes to motivation, the motivation for this oppression?
Well, I think the motivation was twofold originally. I mean, I think part of the motivation was just outright racism. There were people like George Wallace, like Ross Barnett in Mississippi, that didn't really believe that black people should have the right to vote. But I also think it was motivated by political power, that white segregationist governors were concerned that if they allowed African-American voters to register, that they would be voted out of office. And indeed, that's what happened in many places. If you look at the 1970s, for example, compared to the 1960s, you saw a whole wave of moderate white governors elected throughout the South, people like Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton, as opposed to people like George Wallace. Or the segregationists themselves had to modify it and become more moderate. And so I think that is really why the Voting Rights Act has remained so controversial to this day, because it really did shift political power. It gave political power to people that had no power, to people that had been historically disenfranchised, and that obviously provoked a very swift backlash from those people that had maintained power for so many years through suppressing votes.
So do you believe that what we're seeing today and what we have seen over the past several years still is motivated by racism, or is it just an attempt, not just, but is it an attempt to win elections at all costs?
I think it's a combination of the two. I think it's about the intersection of race and political power. So if you look, for example, at recent court decisions that struck down voting restrictions in places like North Carolina, the court dealt with this issue, and they basically said that the North Carolina legislature had taken a number of attempts to try to disenfranchise black voters, because black voters are the strongest base of the Democratic Party, both in North Carolina and nationally. But the court also said that just because they were trying to disenfranchise black voters because they were Democrats didn't make the disenfranchisement any more excusable, meaning it doesn't really matter why you try to disenfranchise someone, whether it's motivated by racism or it's motivated by partisanship. The fact that they are being disenfranchised isn't of itself the problem.
So what do you do about that problem?
Well, I mean, I think you do a few different things. Number one, I think that these laws should be struck down because, as court decisions in North Carolina have made very clear, they're not about stopping voter fraud, because the problem of voter fraud is incredibly rare, particularly the problem of voter impersonation, which voter ID laws are meant to address. But people are definitely being suppressed, that people are definitely being disenfranchised. So I think these restrictions, whether it's a strict voter ID law or it's cutbacks to early voting or it's making it harder to register to vote, I think these things should be repealed. But I think we need a broader shift in consciousness of this issue to say that, you know, if your strategy to win an election is by trying to prevent people from voting, you should get a different strategy. And that, particularly for the Republican Party, if they want to distance themselves from someone like Donald Trump and all of the intolerance that surrounds his candidacy, then backing voter suppression is the exact type of thing that would give rise to a demagogue like Donald Trump. And so I think that not only do the laws have to be repealed, but people have to be called out about what they're doing. And I also think that we need to think about the vote as the most fundamental right in democracy and try to figure out on a bipartisan basis how we can bring more people into the political process, not shut more people out.
What do you make of the assertions by the Bernie Sanders campaign that there was suppression throughout the Democratic primary process?
Well, I don't really think the Bernie Sanders campaign made those allegations. I think that some supporters of the Bernie Sanders campaign made those allegations, and I don't think there was a lot of evidence to back that up. I mean, certainly if you look at the emails from the DNC, I mean, they were sort of for Hillary, broadly speaking, some of the people there. But the DNC didn't set any of the voting rules. They didn't change any of the voting rules. None of the electoral procedures were manipulated to benefit Hillary over Sanders. So I've been trying to keep my focus on areas where I know there's real disenfranchisement. I've been chronicling stories in Wisconsin, in North Carolina, in other places of people who were turned away from the polls. And they weren't turned away by the Clinton campaign. They weren't turned away by the Sanders campaign. They were turned away because of voting restrictions that were passed overwhelmingly by Republicans following Barack Obama's election. So that's what I've been focusing on. And I've tried not to get too sidetracked by these other allegations that I haven't seen really any evidence to prove.
Here is my flip question, okay? So sure. you can go into, I can go into a, internationally, go anywhere pretty much in the world, go to an ATM, put in my card and take out an exact number of cash, and within seconds that is duly noted in my account and all is right with the world. With that analogy, why is it so difficult for us in this country to come up with some uniform system in voting so that everyone can cast a fair ballot?
Well, we could come up with a uniform system. We're not lacking for ideas on how to do it. We're lacking for the political will to implement those ideas. We could give everyone a national ID card and solve the problem of voter ID. We could automatically register everybody to vote and solve the problem of voter registration. There's a lot we could do to fix the system. The problem is people aren't interested in fixing it. And in a state like New York, for example, both parties aren't interested in fixing it because those politicians that are in power want to preserve the status quo. So I mean, I think there's a lot of different ways to make the electoral system work better, to try to make it more reflective of 21st century America as opposed to 19th century America, which is what the electoral system looks like in a lot of different places. I just think we have to have the political will to want to do this, and right now it's really not there.
There was a graphic in the New York Times this week that showed 9% of America chose Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton as the nominees.
Yeah.
The people who actually voted, the rest were people who don't vote in primaries, people who just don't vote, and the people who can't vote. That is a startling number.
It really is startling, and you have to think about how much money goes into these campaigns compared to how few people vote in them. The first thing I always tell everyone is a quarter of Americans aren't even registered to vote. Over 50 million Americans who are eligible to register aren't even registered. So they're not even part of the conversation. And I think we have to make much more of an effort to try to get those people registered. And that's why I'm for policies like automatic voter registration, which is, you know, when you're 18 and if you can prove you're a U.S. citizen, you should be automatically registered to vote, which states like Oregon are starting to do at the DMV. Everyone who gets a driver's license or an ID at the DMV is now automatically registered in Oregon if they prove they're a U.S. citizen. So I think that's a first step. I also think we have to remember that there's very strict rules for voting in primaries and voting in caucuses. If you have a caucus like in Iowa, you have to show up on a weekday night and you have to be there for 3 hours. You can't vote absentee. You have to vote in front of all of your neighbors. I mean, on one hand, it's democratic. On the other hand, it's incredibly anti-democratic. In primaries in New York, as was well discussed, the deadline to register either for a Democratic or Republican to be able to vote in the primary was 6 months before the actual primary. So the deadline closed when nobody was paying attention, and these kind of things prevented a lot of people from voting. So, like I said, I think there's a lot we could do to try to get more people to participate, but I think it starts with the intention to actually try to do so.
Ari Berman is a political correspondent for The Nation and an investigative journalism fellow at The Nation Institute. His new book, just out in paperback, Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. It is published by Picador. Ari Berman, thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Joe. I appreciate it.
Again, the name of the book is Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America by Ari Berman. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.